I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, as part of our ongoing focus on education and educational issues, we're going to talk about school discipline. There have been high-profile breaks in school discipline, brawls at basketball games and other large-scale incidents, and lower-level altercations that create ongoing tension. We're going to talk about the challenges, what the challenges are in regard to maintaining school discipline, and how those challenges may have evolved over time. My guests are Mara Weiss of Reach for Youth, which also operates Teen Court here, and Katie Dorsey, a school counselor at Heron High School. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about school discipline. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, my guests today are Mara Weiss, who is with Reach for Youth. She has a lot of other titles with initials and letters that I'm not going to go into, which also operates Teen Court locally. And Katie Dorsey, who's a school counselor specializing in problem solving and interventions for students at Heron High School. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
It's good to have both of you here. So we probably ought to talk. I mean, most of the attention and school discipline, it strikes me, is such a huge subject that there are many ways we can kind of enter the conversation. But the elephant in the room is probably we've had some high-profile incidents. Mm-hmm. That seem to indicate to people that that we're moving into a new era, if we haven't moved into it already, and that the problems are not just different in scope, but to some degree different in nature, perhaps, than they have been before. A, is there any truth to that? And, I guess we shouldn't even ask B until we've addressed A. So I'll start with you, Mara.
Well, I think that's an interesting question. Obviously, as we're noting these high-profile incidents, the first thing I think we need to recognize is the use of social media. How aware would we have been of these incidents if the students weren't able to take video? I think that's kind of the first thing we want to keep in mind. And with how serious the incidents seem to be getting from the news reports we're getting and what we're seeing on TV and hearing on the radio, is that a function of the social media, students sharing information, them wanting the attention? And that's one of the things that I always kind of consider is that that's different from previous generations, even my generation, is we didn't have that social media.
Katie, is that, and I realize I'm walking into some very dangerous territory here, and I want to take care that we don't make this, a show, a discussion about First Amendment rights or anything like that. Not that those issues are not important, obviously, but the focus here, I think, is really on schools and what's going on inside them. Is the presence of, to use Mara's point, does the fact that, we've got cell phones with these, video camera capabilities that now shoot video that's better than broadcast quality would have been 40 years ago, serve as kind of an escalating factor? Do we see students, in effect, performing for the camera?
I think escalating is the exact word that you would use to describe that situation. So a situation that we could handle with pretty traditional conflict resolution skills or conflict resolution within a school setting, when social media is involved, it really can escalate into something that is much more far-reaching, that more people have access to see, comment on, and do what they will with. I think the key issue in this whole conversation is safety at school, that students need to feel safe in order to learn, and they need to be in a safe environment where they are known and where education is the priority and problem solving can happen so that students can learn safely.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about school discipline here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. So we see these situations now. We know more about them. But I'm going to go back to my first question. I mean, we can see that that it doesn't sound like social media, at least in your views, is necessarily an instigator. It's like an aggravator. It's
exactly.
Something that once the problem occurs, it can multiply it as it were. But it's not the thing that starts it inevitably. So I'm going to go back to the original question. Are we dealing with something that is different in nature from the kind of school discipline problems? And I realize I'm asking the two of you, realizing that unless I miss my guess, you don't have much knowledge of what school was like before, say, the 1990s.
I think you're right.
But are we talking about a different kind of environment now? I'll start with Katie and then go with Mara.
So you're right, my experience is limited, but I would say teenagers are teenagers. And part of what happens developmentally with teenagers is they are pushing boundaries and they are trying to form their identity, figure out where they fit in society with their peers, what they might become interested in or become passionate about. And so part of that pursuit of their own identity involves pushing boundaries. And we know that that has been something that teenagers have been doing forever. And so I don't know that we're dealing with something that is different by nature than what has been dealt with for past generations. I think some of the developments, especially in technology, make it a different beast. You know, we have to really be smart when we know that students have access 24/7 to a venue that they didn't have access to before in social media.
Mara.
I'm glad you brought up the 1990s because I remember being in school when zero tolerance policies really started to take effect. Mm-hmm. And that was in the 1990s. And that's when we started to see this criminalization of youth. Exactly what Katie was saying, that these are typical teenage behaviors. They're pushing the boundaries. They're looking for an adult to teach them, where's that boundary? When do I need to stop? And what happened to them is that the zero tolerance policies said you need to behave like an adult. You can't do anything inappropriate. If you do, there is a serious consequence for that. And so that's when we started to see a change in how we deal with their behaviors. The behaviors have remained the same.
Are we trapped by that sort of zero tolerance mentality or, legacy even now? I mean, I know in a lot of places, like a lot of college campuses, adopted zero tolerance policies in regard to alcohol consumption and all of that, and discovered, because they hadn't really been thinking through the consequences in the time because of the tremendous social and political pressures exerted at the time, that if students couldn't drink on campus, they were going to get into cars, go someplace else and drink, and then people were going to start dying as a result of it. So without being able to say so, many of them began adjusting their policies and saying, okay, we're going to try to keep these things on campus so we can keep an eye on them and keep them under control rather than, sending these kids out somewhere where nobody's watching what they're doing. Mara.
Well, fortunately, what I've seen schools starting to realize and what the data is telling us is zero tolerance doesn't work. And I think a lot of people in the field already knew that, but it was their attempt to provide that safety that Katie was talking about. But what we know is there's a significant amount of trauma that these youth go through. And if we don't consider how that trauma affects their behaviors in school, the way that they do their schoolwork, then we're ignoring a huge piece of how they're going to be successful. And so I'm seeing schools starting to take a different approach with the use of PBIS, positive behavioral interventions and supports, and restorative justice practices like in-school teen court. We're seeing more use of alternatives to suspension and expulsion, and I think that's great.
Katie.
I definitely agree. I think if you have zero tolerance, you remove the element of the student being known and the solution being able to fit the student and the unique problem that has been presented. So if you have a one-size-fits-all solution for students, it's really hard to actually meet their needs and prevent the problem from happening in the future if they're no longer a part of your school, part of your community.
What are the greatest challenges in imposing school discipline right now? I mean, where are the stress points in the system? Mm-hmm. Katie?
One of the harder stresses that I see is making sure that both the students who might be within the discipline system are being treated equitably and fairly and justly, and also school is continuing to be a safe place. And so balancing the rights of the individuals and the rights of the student population at large and figuring out how do we best meet the needs of the entire school population. And that's something that has to be taken really seriously. How do we treat everyone in a way that is equitable?
And that's one of the things, I mean, I will say for our listeners that I'm at least a moment or two older than both of you. And I don't remember when I was in school really feeling physically afraid. Mm-hmm. Even though, you know, I was kind of a geek and a nerd. Mm-hmm. And it, for goodness sakes, when I was in high school, I was the president of the Latin club. You don't get much geekier than that.
You would have fit in well at Heron.
And yet I hear in talking with young people these days that many of them do feel physical fear in the context of school, that it is an ordeal for them to go there. We talk a lot more about bullying and other mm-hmm. issues now than we certainly did during the time that I was in school. And I guess that's where I'd like to go with this next section is, where are the points of real conflict where these young people need some sort of intervention by adults mm-hmm. to make the system work? Mara, I'm going to throw that one to you.
Well, again, you know, I love social media. I'm glad we have it. Mm-hmm. But if you're talking about bullying, for instance, I spent a few days last week with some fifth graders, and we talked about how bullying has always been a thing. They were able to identify how bullying happened in the past. But again, now we have the social media. The bullying does not stop at school. It doesn't stop once they get off the bus. They go home. It's in their bedroom. It's in their living room. It's when they go to the park, when they go on vacation with their family. It's still there. So we see them kind of inundated. And then, you know, as they're watching the news or listening to news with their parents, they get to hear about what happened in Washington State. And if there was a safety issue in Washington State at a school, they get to know about that as well. So they're just kind of inundated with all these threats to their safety.
So say I'm going to stay with you for a second, Mara. Say I am a parent or, you know, a teacher or educator in one of these schools. I mean, a lot of that is happening, it sounds like, by definition, in places I'm not likely to know about. Mm-hmm. You know, how do I deal with that? How do I keep an eye on that? And then after that, we're going to ask, if you're a kid involved in those situations, how do you deal with it?
I feel like it's such an easy answer is talk to your student, talk to your child. Often, seeing even in our waiting room, I watch and I have a kid sitting on their phone looking down and a parent sitting on their phone looking down. And I ask on the way over, what'd you guys do? Well, I was sitting on my phone while my mom was driving. Or she was talking on the phone while I was on my phone. And so they're just not even talking, and it's hard to be able to pay attention to things that you don't always have access to, like their Facebook account, if you don't even talk to them and ask them what's going on.
Katie.
So you had asked about from the student perspective, and I just see such a need for boundaries with teenagers and helping them establish boundaries for themselves. And then also when they can't establish their own, the adults in their lives helping to put boundaries in place that will keep them safe and help them not get into these conflicts that then could escalate.
How do you encourage young people to have that kind of conversation, though? I mean, again, mm-hmm. I grew up in a different era, but at least at that point, saying to my parents that there was something going on at school that I couldn't deal with would have been a mortifying experience for
right.
me. And I can't believe that my experience was that isolated.
Mm-hmm. It isn't always the parents. They're not always the front line with teenagers mm-hmm. because they are pushing back. They are challenging authority, and parents are that number one authority figure. And so that is where other school adults can come into play. So if the parents aren't the ones that the students feel comfortable with, right away. Maybe it's a teacher, it is a school counselor, an administrator, someone that could be that sounding board to help the student problem solve, develop critical thinking skills, and set those boundaries. And then hopefully the parents can get involved as well.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about school discipline here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. That's a toll-free number. You also can reach out to us via email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Mara Weiss, who is with Reach for Youth, which also operates Teen Court here locally, and Katie Dorsey, who is a school counselor specializing in problem solving and interventions for students at Heron High School. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about school discipline and teen issues. My guests are Mara Weiss, who is with Reach for Youth, which also operates Teen Court here locally, and Katie Dorsey, who is a school counselor specializing in problem solving and interventions for students at Heron High School. Well, we probably ought to ask, since I've introduced it twice, I ought to ask you what Teen Court is.
Absolutely. So Reach for Youth operates two teen court programs. We've been operating our traditional teen court program since 1989. And that program serves youth in Marion and Johnson counties who have been arrested for nonviolent first-time offenses. And they are judged by a jury of their peers, other students, who listen to what's going on in their life and provide constructive consequences to help them pay back the harm to the community as well as make better decisions in the future. We have adapted that program in schools within the last 3 years, and now we operate in 12 schools in Marion County and provide that as an alternative to suspension or expulsion.
And when you say nonviolent offenses, what sort of offenses are we talking about that qualify for this sort of treatment?
Absolutely. So research actually tells us that the most common in-school behaviors that we're seeing that are resulting in suspension or expulsion are defiance. And what I always liken that to when we're looking at criminal justice charges is disorderly conduct. So are you disrupting the orderly process? Students are allowed to be in school. They're supposed to feel safe in school, as we've talked about. And that's disorderly conduct in the community. So that's often what we see is that general defiance, not following school rules, possession of marijuana or paraphernalia or alcohol on school property, tardies and truancy. And we do see low-level batteries, so school fights. We do allow for that, if appropriate, if there's no harm.
What sort of baggage, emotional, psychological, otherwise, do these young people bring to school with them now? And I guess I'm asking this in the context of, I'm presuming things like, brawls at athletic contests don't come without a few escalating steps beforehand. What are some of the warning signs, or at least the signs that a problem might be developing? I'll start with you, Katie.
I'm glad you asked, John, because I think asking the question of why or what else is going on in this student's life is a very important question when you're trying to solve the problem, which is the goal. The goal is to solve the problem so that everyone can learn. And so issues related to poverty are incredibly significant. If a student doesn't have his or her basic needs met, that is going to be at the forefront of their mind. It's going to be really hard for them to think critically, problem solve, think about the consequences of their actions. If their first priority every day is, do I have food? Do I have shelter? Do I have a safe way to get to school on time? And so those issues really can limit a student's ability to make good choices. If they're spending a lot of their emotional energy first trying to get through the day in a safe way for themselves and for their families.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about school discipline. And if you would like to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Danielle did and reach out to us on Facebook, and that you can find us there at No Limits, WFYI. Danielle says, I remember in 1991, there was a huge riot at my high school, Warren. Before that time, students were able to come and go during lunchtime. After that, the lunchroom was locked down during lunch. No passes out. Also, there were no procedures for an in-school emergency, like an internal lockdown. I'm wondering what the effect is on students who feel locked down with no choices or freedom during school hours. Do you think that exacerbates in-school situations? I'll throw that one first tomorrow, I guess.
So Warren is actually one of the schools that I piloted teen court in. So I love that school because they're really focusing on what alternatives do we have. But Katie mentioned safety at the beginning, and I think that's so important as Danielle's asking that question. Are students feeling unsafe in that situation, you know, where they're having to practice a lockdown drill because then they're thinking about, is this a situation that could occur? And also just thinking about what students are looking for during that school day. There's already maybe trauma coming in. We're talking about, you know, the Maslow's hierarchy of these are the basic needs. We talk about hangry a lot. I think that's like the new keyword. I know when I'm hungry, I can't focus on anything else. So we have students who are like, I don't have a home to go to tonight. I'm not sure that my parents are going to have a job tomorrow. So you pair that with not feeling safe in school and those lockdowns and what are they supposed to do during the day but focus on getting through the day and not focus on their schoolwork or how they respond to situations if it's appropriate or not.
But there is an environment now. I mean, and again, I don't want to sound like one of those old coots who said, you know, I had to walk 7 miles to school every day and it was uphill both ways and snowing all the time and all of that. But, you know, there were times that you were going to school in this country in almost every community and there weren't, you know, metal detectors at the doors and things like that. The sense that you always have to be, if not worried about your safety, at least conscious of it, I would think has to have some sort of effect on young people. Katie?
Absolutely. I think it is a very unique challenge for a school to both bring that element of safety, but make sure that joy is not lost in the education process. Students should also be very excited to walk through the metal detector into the school building. It should be a place that they feel known, they feel loved, and they are experiencing the joy of learning. And so if a school can, in some ways, embrace the technology that we can use to make a school a safe environment, but also make sure that the students feel that it's an enjoyable place to be, I think you're going to get much more mileage with the students and getting them to buy in to your discipline system, to the expectations. Maybe they can't leave campus at lunch, but hopefully it's not, you know, the cafeteria isn't too bad of a place to be, would be the ideal.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about school discipline here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by giving us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you today?
Doing well, thank you. What's on your mind?
I was a teacher in IPS. I was an alternative education teacher in my first couple of years out of college. I graduated when I was 40. You know, we would have... I was tasked with teach the kids some self-control and then release them back to the classroom. And I was very successful at it, but these kids came to the ones that I couldn't release back to the classroom. You know, there were some outrageous things going on. One example that I wanted, there was a boy who came to school every Monday with a seventh grader who had come to school every Monday with $200 to $250 in his pocket because his family and he was participating, you know, in the distribution of the illegal pharmaceuticals that way. So I'd like to hear your panel comment on that. So help me out. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
The
Thanks, Paul.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Mara?
So the purpose of Teen Court is to create this culture of accountability. And we're starting with the youth because we know that they're resilient and they're malleable. We can teach them still. They've created these behaviors usually as a result of if they're inappropriate, usually as a result of some trauma, but they're trying to deal the best that they can. And then when we have home situations like this, then they're doing what they've learned. So part of it is recognizing, okay, what's going on within our community and our family, and what can we do as a community to address that? You asked earlier about, what are the barriers to us kind of changing the way this looks? And I always say resources. Katie and I were talking before we were on air, and we have the same resources, and they don't have a lot of funding or availability for the amount of students that need access to them for the various issues that they have. So it's recognizing that the family unit and the community unit it takes a village to raise a child. And recognizing these behaviors before they become a real issue where they're being suspended, expelled, arrested is super important. Don't wait until, you're seeing that expulsion paperwork before you decide to take them in for treatment.
I'll give you both a crack at this. If the question is in part resources, if you were given more resources, let's make both of you gods, goddesses of education policy here in the state of Indiana, where would you spend them? Where would the money go? Katie?
I would use it to help identify the needs of the students for themselves and their families, and then help meet those needs, whatever they are. So for some students, those are financial needs related to poverty. For some, mental health needs, conflict within the home. And we know that if we can problem solve and troubleshoot, we try really hard to connect a student and his or her family with the right resource in the city to help meet their need. But identifying what those needs are can be overwhelming. So I think that's what I need help with, is identifying where are the gaps for the student and his or her family, and what can we connect them to in the city.
Mara, where would you spend the money if you had more of it?
I work for a nonprofit, so I would put it into the community. So Katie's saying, let's identify those resources. Well, we exist, but the funding that we have to be able to serve is limited, and we do our best to serve everyone, regardless of inability to pay or ability to pay. But there's only so much we can do. We're a small staff, and we're not unique. Unfortunately, that's across the city. And our goal is to be able to then support schools so they identify their needs, and then we're able to meet those needs or help them find another community resource that can also meet those needs. But we have to be willing to put that money in there versus putting it in at the back end for when we're incarcerating.
Mm-hmm. If you are just joining us, we are talking about school discipline here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, Katie, I'm going to start with you on this. In terms of the sort of daily and ongoing challenges you deal with, and admittedly, Heron is a somewhat unusual environment for schools. What are the major stress points, the things you have to spend most of your time focusing on?
A lot of it for me comes down to conflict resolution, and that's either conflict between peers or a student who arrives in duress because of a conflict they had with a parent in the car on the way to school, or with a boyfriend or girlfriend via social media the night before. Or sometimes it is a conflict between a teacher and a student that can lead to that disorderly conduct that Mara mentioned. But so much of it, Paul, the caller, mentioned self-control and that he was tasked with teaching teenagers self-control, which is quite an uphill battle because we know their frontal lobes aren't fully connected yet. They don't have complete critical thinking skills. They can't foresee consequences entirely and really won't be able to until they're 25. So it's dealing with building the conflict resolution, the assets within the student so that they can help troubleshoot their own problems before they become a barrier to learning.
Mara, how about you?
So I see a lot of anger. And what I always try to remind parents, teachers, other students is that anger is often masking other mental health issues, most notably depression. As a culture, we're kind of used to this anger now. We see a lot of fights. It's just kind of become common versus when we see someone depressed. I was working with a group of high school students yesterday, and they said, we don't know what to do when we see someone crying. We want to help, but we have no idea what to say. Do I go hug them? So that untreated mental health that then is resulting in other behaviors, and we have such a huge stigma still regarding mental health and accessing mental health resources. And I think to be able to address some of the these other behaviors, we have to recognize that mental health is something we all need to address.
Is that anger that's masking depression more prevalent today, or is it just better that is it just that we are better at detecting it now? Was it always there and we just let it slide or assumed it was something other than it was? Or are we seeing more of it now?
I think we're better at understanding what it actually means. We're better at understanding mental health in general. The stigma is still there. We know 1 in 4 adults has a diagnosable mental illness, but we're able to at least start to recognize, okay, depression is a real thing. We understand that it affects a lot of people and that you can also live a healthy life if you can get the proper treatment for it. And so we're also starting to recognize that, especially for teenagers, that's their way of expressing maybe depression is through that anger, because that feels like a safer way to try to communicate with a parent when you can't tell, you feel like you can't tell your parent, I'm feeling really sad. Instead, I show them I'm feeling really angry, because maybe you're going to leave me alone then, because I don't want anyone to be near me when I'm feeling sad.
Katie, in terms of this, what are the triggers you see with students that produce this depression? I mean, mm-hmm. some of it I'm assuming is chemical, but there are other mm-hmm. sort of environmental circumstances that can drive depression as well. Is it a fairly common occurrence?
It is. Actually, the encouraging thing to me is that we know that depression and anxiety in teens is highly curable, and not just treatable, but curable with mental health support, with medical support as well. And so for teens who might be experiencing depression, experiencing anxiety, or any other mental health concern, it is so critical that they get the support and the care that they need, because that is such a prime time in helping that student relearn how to manage, how to cope with their emotions and build skills that they will be able to use in their mental health for the rest of their lives. So we find this to be a critical time for teenage mental health to be treated seriously so that they can set themselves up to be healthy for the rest of their lives.
We had a guest on the show not long ago who said that the most important question dealing with troubled young people now is not sort of asking them to explain their behavior or whatever, but to say what happened, mm-hmm. that there are these life events that can have tremendous mm-hmm. impact. And I'm using that sort of as a springboard mm-hmm. to have we been attempting to impose school discipline in many of the wrong ways for years? Mara's shaking her head.
Absolutely.
Up and down. So talk about the things we've done that haven't been effective.
There was a study done called the ACEs study, Adverse Childhood Experiences, and it gives you a number to figure out what types of trauma a child has had and then where they are kind of on this continuum in terms of the trauma they've experienced. And what we do when we suspend, expel, arrest is we tell them that school is no longer a safe place. No one understands. They're just going to kick you out because they don't want to deal with you anymore. We tell them you don't really have to be held accountable for your behavior. You leave, but where are you going to go? Usually you don't go to work with your parents. Usually you stay home, play video games. Maybe you're grounded. You sit in your room. You watch some TV. So we're kicking them out of
this. And those are actually the least destructive options.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
we're kicking them out of a structured, caring environment when they've dealt with a lot of trauma, usually in the past, that's creating then these behaviors that we're not dealing with. So we're adding to that trauma of now no one wants me because they've kicked me out of this school. They just can't express it that same way. They're angry.
We are talking about school discipline here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Mara Weiss and Katie Dorsey. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about school discipline today. My guests are Mara Weiss, who is with Reach for Youth, which also operates Teen Court here locally, and Katie Dorsey, who is a school counselor specializing in problem solving and interventions for students at Heron High School. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Sandy did and send us an email. The way to do that is to send it to nolimits@wfyi.org. Sandy says, first of all, thank you for the opportunity to respond to this crisis in our schools. I have been substituting township and charter schools for 2 years, and I can only say that I am appalled. I eliminated high schools after last year, and this year did the same with middle schools. So my response is what I am seeing at the elementary level. If a classroom has a handful of students that are unable to control their behavior, they are essentially disrupting the learning process for the rest of the students in the classroom. The role of the teacher then becomes one of a disciplinarian, not a teacher or anything that resembles teaching. I can only believe that if successful intervention is not done at an early age, the actions just become worse as the student moves through the system, and that the inappropriate behaviors just escalate. Katie.
I certainly sympathize with anything from a substitute teacher. What a challenging role to sometimes step in. All of a sudden, you are an adult in a room with teenagers who don't know you, and they aren't necessarily known by you. So already that is such a challenging situation, because we know that the relationship of trust is key in having a school environment be a safe, predictable place. So the art of teaching and of managing a classroom environment with all the different dynamics that students bring in, it really is an art form, but I think it's one that can be done, can be accomplished. I don't think that today's teenagers, we don't have a situation now where teens can't be controlled or where things are out of control. We know that there are best practices in building a culture in a classroom that's positive, that's safe. And it is a challenge, but it can be done.
Is there, sort of the premise here is if you don't intervene early, to some degree, all hope is lost. Is that the case? Are there points of no return with some of this behavior, Mara? And presumably the premise here is that everything escalates. Are there cases where there's early misbehavior in elementary school that at some level becomes self-correcting?
So I will say that there's not a time when you just can't control that behavior anymore. I don't think that's fair to put on youth, because that's absolutely not correct. It's what are we going to do to help them understand? In what I do, that would be really difficult for me to say, especially because I work mostly with high school students and occasionally with middle school as well. But what I found as I've gone into classrooms and done workshops where I become that adult that's supposed to be in charge, but they don't know me, is that the more structure there is in that classroom, not strict necessarily, but it's structured and the students understand what the structure is. They understand this is where I go put my work. I always know that on the right side of the board, this is where the homework's going to be written. The more structure there is, that sets up the boundaries that we've talked about, and that's how they learn. We all need those boundaries, but especially for students, youth and adolescents, it's so important that as adults we set up those structures to show them what the boundaries look like, and that's what helps them learn. Certainly the earlier the intervention, the better, but there's no time when there's no point of return.
We've got a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air, who called in. And if you want to do that and you don't want to talk on the air, you still can call us at 866-476-3881. Ask your question, we'll try to figure out a way to get it asked for you. And this caller said, the role of the school is to educate, not to play parent. Shouldn't it be the school's job to raise, it shouldn't be the school's job to raise a child. If kids feel unsafe, the unruly students should be kicked out. Mara, I suspect from your earlier comments you have some fairly strong feelings about this. So I'm going to let you have the first crack at that.
I do. You know, taking people away from their community only serves to isolate them, especially youth. They need that connection to not only other youth, but to caring adults, which is what our schools are full of. It doesn't matter if they're a teacher or administrator or a counselor or a janitor. They're there because they want to support our youth. So kicking them out of whatever structure that environment might give them only serves to further isolate them from any structure that they might have and any positive supports. The kind of the whole purpose of teen court is this this peer accountability and creating this culture of accountability and recognizing the influence of positive peer pressure. We talk so much about negative peer pressure, but positive peer pressure exists when as students they hold other students accountable. So recognizing the power that has when you keep a student in a structured environment in school, but maybe you take them out and you give them a timeout. Where they can go sit in an office and be able to calm down for a little bit before they're able to return to the learning environment.
Are there situations in which the behavior, though, is so disruptive that it should not be tolerated? Mara, you're nodding your head. That doesn't work so well on radio.
So certainly, you know, we have to keep in mind safety, and we want to make sure that the other students are able to learn. But that's why I recommend, you know, there are students who have like hall passes where they can step out into the hall. They're allowed to do that. The teacher knows that they're allowed to do that. That gives them that break from the learning environment. Maybe there's a room they go to. IPS at Broderbowl has a great place called the Respect Center. And that's a classroom where they're able to then go talk with staff. They have peer groups where they talk as well. So that's a way to get them out of that learning environment where maybe it's disruptive, but puts them into another structured short-term environment where they're practicing different behaviors that are going to help them be successful.
I've gotten an email question from a listener named Shannon. And if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Says, what advice do you have for parents resistant to admitting that their teens might need counseling, therapy, an ADHD diagnosis, or even an IEP? The stigma can stop them. Katie.
I love to talk with parents about how information can be power. And many of us, we might have a gut feeling about a student and what's going on, but until we can get some professional insight, we really don't know what we're working with. And so I talk with parents about seek more information, talk with a professional, whether it's a medical professional, a mental health professional, maybe a special education resource professional within their school. Seek more information about your student, for your student, and then figure out what you want to do about it. If you write off all mental health care before you even know the information about your specific child, I think you're at a disadvantage. So seeking more information is a really great, hopefully neutral way for parents to be able to think about, okay, this might need to be what I need to do for my kid.
Well, the parents are one issue. I would think the students are another, too. I mean, many of the students are going to be reluctant mm-hmm. to assume these labels. In that case, how do you structure the conversation with the students or the young person? Because mm-hmm. I think we're all in agreement. There's a stigma mm-hmm. here that's attached to it. We probably all wish it were mm-hmm. otherwise, but you know, we can't wave a wand and make it disappear. Mm-hmm. So how do you go about having that kind of conversation with a student who clearly needs some help mm-hmm. but clearly is not ready to embrace that help? Mm-hmm. Mara, I'll start with you, but I'm going to give Katie a crack at that one too.
So as a mental health professional, I deal with that daily where people are maybe recommended to come, but they're really not interested in counseling because of that stigma. And the way that I present it to the youth and parent, this is a safe place to talk. you know, we have these old ideas. You're going to lay down on a couch and tell me all your problems and I'm going to solve them. And yes, I have a couch in my office, but because it's comfortable and I have kids who take off their shoes and lay down if they want to, if that's what's comfortable, or I have art materials. If they just want to draw that day, they don't have to talk to me. It's just about creating that safe place for them to communicate in whatever way is comfortable for them, and helping them recognize it's not about me solving your problems. It's about me asking, what are your goals? How can I help you achieve your goals?
Katie.
Yeah, I think teenagers desperately want to feel confident. They want to feel known. They want to be part of a group. And they can sense that disconnect. Sometimes I'll ask students if I can tell something's going on. I'll say, I bet you're not really feeling like yourself today. And they'll say, yeah, I don't really feel like myself today. And so we can start from that position of what type of resources can we bring on board? What type of goals can we set so that you can feel really confident exactly as who you are, and then bring that confidence into the school setting?
When they say they don't feel like themselves, I mean, is there generally some sort of precipitating reason for that? Goal to try to get at what that might be?
And it might be just a phrase that works for me, but in some ways that's a way for a student, you know, if they're not comfortable telling me I feel sad or I feel really anxious about the situation at my home, or I feel depressed potentially, they might not be willing to start at that level of emotional identification, but they might be able to start by saying, you know, I know I'm supposed to feel differently than how I feel right now. What can we do about that?
I've gotten an email from a listener named Anastasia, who says, I heard that Indianapolis has been sanctioned because of its overuse of school discipline, and now it particularly impacts at-risk youth of color, and how it particularly impacts at-risk youth of color. Can you address this claim? How can we be more in line with the school districts that are pursuing alternative methodologies to discipline? Mara.
So the last results that I have are from a 2008 United Way study of community, and it says that Indiana ranks third in expulsion and 12th in suspension in the country, and we have been identified as disproportionately suspending and expelling youth of color, males, as well as youth receiving special education services, and so I think, with the school recognizing that those are issues, but I would argue that we're seeing use of suspension, expulsion, and arrest for all students. And when we're looking at defiance as the reason for that, I think that's inappropriate for the most part, as our kind of go-to, that we can put other resources into place, other supports into place. And it's just about the school, first of all, recognizing it. And sometimes that can come from a lower level. We have a school counselor that can say something. Sometimes it needs to come from the superintendent. But part of that is parents and students speaking up and saying that this is affecting us, and we need to see something different. And what's the school already doing? Because maybe they have something in place and it's small, but people just aren't aware of it.
That resource question we talked about a little earlier, the information you cited, by my math, is 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Is part of it that we don't, you know, however much hand-wringing we do about all of this, we don't do enough in terms of studying the causes of these problems and trying to get accurate information, mm-hmm. so that we can plot our course. We have general agreement on that?
Yeah, we're agreeing.
Okay. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I will say we're starting to get a little tight on time, so I'm going to ask both our callers and Mara and Katie to be a little bit tight in questions and answers. Greg, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I've been a sentencing consultant that specialized in juvenile cases, and I've been a mental health clinician for 35 years, and I have a little bit of a concept of what happens in the classroom and what these kids go through and put each other through. So if we're going to refer a kid for our mental health services, and many times whether the kid likes it or not, and we've overcome the stigma and whatnot, which I think is a significant issue, what's going to stop the bullying that's already at an epidemic, and I mean lethal, level that's going on in our school systems?
Thanks very much for the call. Great question, Greg. Katie.
Well, we know, and there's been actually some great work by school counselors in the state of Indiana about this. Empathy building is the antidote to bullying. If students can empathize with one another, if they can picture walking in one another's shoes, it really can decrease bullying behaviors. And so we have to bring that curriculum into the school setting. We have to help parents and families access it and help students learn to empathize as a way that antidote to bullying.
Mara, I'll give you a real quick crack at that, too.
I mentioned earlier that culture of accountability, and I think that's so important. We talk about bystanders, and even just giving an audience to bullying is promoting it, whether or not you're doing it knowingly or unknowingly. So having these upstanders, students who are willing to say something and use that empathy is really important.
We are talking about school discipline here on No Limits. Sally, welcome to the program.
Hi. My issue is I have a 17-year-old grandson, and he got in trouble last fall. He went to juvenile. He's done his penance. And the thing of it is, the high school they attended, I think, will not allow him to come back. He has been out of school since January, and we need to get him back into a structured environment. He has had, of course, some discipline issues. He also has ADHD. And we just don't know which way to go. I don't feel that the school he was at gave the direction to my son and his mom as to what to do when he got to this point. So he's, you know, just about filled his requirement that he was supposed to do. But now what we do? He's 17, and he needs to be back in a structured school environment. I'm very involved with my alumni, and I know that there are not some of the alternative schools in Indy are being closed. And as one lady said, we're on some type of, penance ourselves for, sending too many kids, you know, to the principal or whatever, you know. And it's and I'm African-American. My grandson is, too. So I just need some advice on what to do so that they can put him back into a structured environment where he learns that he has to abide by the rules just like everyone else.
Sally, if
that's
I could, yeah, let me see if I can get an answer for you because we are getting tight on time.
I know you're getting tight on time.
Thank you very much for the call and the question. Mara, I'll start with you.
The biggest challenge I always have is connecting and coordinating care. And so I would immediately say that's the first thing to do. She mentioned ADHD. She mentioned some juvenile issues and then school. And the first thing I do is get releases signed so I can be the one to talk to school and juvenile and coordinate everyone so that we're all on the same page.
Katie, I'm going to give you the last word on this.
Well, I think Sally is already, I can hear she's a great advocate for her grandson, which means she might be the one to make those initial phone calls back to his home school district, find out the details of his expulsion, find out what exactly the resources available through that homeschool district are, reach out to a mental health resource, potentially someone that can get support for ADHD, the juvenile system. It takes a lot of legwork on behalf of caring adults to make sure that the student is in a safe learning environment, but it is so worth it.
And that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank both of my guests, Mara Weiss of Reach for Youth and Katie Dorsey from Heron High School. It's been a pleasure talking with both of you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And I'd like to also thank our listeners and particularly those who called in or sent messages. This is an important conversation. It's one we're going to have again. I do hope you will enjoy the Memorial Day weekend. I understand there's some big sporting event going on here in the city this weekend. I am John Krall. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
Is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.